The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Well, Rocky and Bullwinkle really started something just by trying to bake a cake. For instead of dessert, they wound up with an explosive that blew their stove clean to the moon. The nation was astounded.
That cake batter must be a revolutionary rocket fuel.
Grandma called it fudge cake.
Bullwinkle was immediately made director of guided missiles, and he and Rocky set out to duplicate the recipe, which unfortunately had been torn in half by the explosion. But apparently not everybody wanted them to succeed, for when we left them last time, a scaly green hand was raising a sinister weapon and pointing it right at their heads.
Hokey smoke, Bullwinkle! Look there!
Now, Kidney?
Not now, Clyde.
Why not? I haven't scrooched anybody since we've been here.
What are they, Rocky?
I don't know. I've never seen anything like them.
Maybe they're congressmen.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, March 13th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
As our opener today suggests, congressmen and politicians are probably alien to most people's experiences.
I've never seen anything like them.
America's State of the Union address was delivered by Joe Biden on the 7th of March and was a mishmash of verbal diarrhea and political rhetoric that serves as a perfect example of why so many people are what I would call political atheists. Political atheists are the people who have either completely lost their faith in what they believed to be the democratic system or never had such faith in the first place. And it also includes the folks who have no interest in politics and only rarely participate in the electoral process by voting, thereby doing more damage than good. Are you or someone you know a political atheist? Yeah, I know it's a bit of a mixed metaphor, but it sure does describe the phenomenon that I'd like to talk about today. And in the process, hopefully cure. The one reality about politics that no one can escape is the fact that even if you're not interested in politics, politics is always and relentlessly interested in you. And political atheists are especially vulnerable to politics, since in their self-imposed political ignorance, they don't know left from right, conservative from liberal, and above all, they don't understand the nature of socialism or any of its collectivist partners in crime. Fascism, communism, and a whole host of ideologies that are anything but freedom and capitalism. And here's a real shocker. I would say that the vast majority of people fall into this category, which is exactly why we're in the tyrannical political mess that we're in. Is there a way out of this mess? Yes, I believe there is, but not if you listen to most of the people who see themselves as freedom fighters. And yes, you heard me right. The freedom fighters, those who see themselves as right-wingers or conservatives or libertarians or just freedom people fighting a liberal and communist left. Because they're a long way from fighting for freedom, they're still blindly fighting against tyranny and don't have a single clue of where they're heading and how to fight for freedom. The proverbial road to freedom is always the road less traveled in politics. And this criticism isn't directed just at our politicians, although it sure does apply to them. The problem is in the people themselves, who find themselves more and more disgusted with and recoiling from the very politics and politicians that they created. We the people created our political monsters, and we the people must destroy and defeat them. How that must be done is not very palatable to most people. As I titled a broadcast of this show recently, politics is simple, it's just not easy. Because of their political atheism, they've thrown away their political ballots and now are facing the reality of having to deal with real bullets. Because politics is all about the rule of force. Force is what is governed, Isabel Patterson reminds us in her book, The God of the Machine. Will the solution to our tyranny be political ballots or real bullets? That's where the current trends are leading, and that's the question that we'll be addressing today, right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because, as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, I've been on the front lines of what most people would call fringe politics for going on the 6 decades, believe it or not, and let me assure you that the political view from the fringes is infinitely clearer than it is within the greater body politic. Define or be defined is perhaps the number one rule in the politics of propaganda and identity. And in terms of epistemology and the use of words to label one's political opponents, I don't think it's a coincidence, given that pejorative use of the word fringe should pertain to numbers and not to ideas and ideologies. Think about it. The ideologies and policies of all the major parties in the West are nothing short of fringe in terms of their intellectual and moral validity. It's the mainstream parties that we should be calling the fringe parties, parties who believe that we can change sexes, change the weather, and change the nature of human existence by injection. I can't think of anything more fringy than that. As I said before, politics is simple, it's just not easy. And the spectacle of thousands of political protesters gathering to fight tyranny back in Alberta a few weeks ago, without having a clue as how this might be done, can only lead to continued tyranny ahead. Though accomplished and expert in their own fields of discipline, whether medicine, law, education, journalism, etc., most of the leading voices in the freedom movement, sadly, are clueless when it comes to the politics of freedom. It's one thing to be able to identify the political condition of tyranny that you're running from. It's quite another to identify the political condition of freedom that you must move towards. Calls for unity or solidarity or for political separation or for creating a republic or for changing the electoral system are not calls for establishing a free society. They are desperate, aimless propositions that amount to a clear admission that the protesters really don't know what must be done. And that's what I said back on that show regarding politics not being easy. Well, this time round, the political fixers aren't talking about creating new political parties or political jurisdictions or even for solidarity and unity. It's worse. Now they argue that political parties themselves should be abolished or that political parties are irrelevant when it comes to any attempts to slow the tyranny and win back our freedom. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. But before we examine that truth, let's give a listen to the latest round of evidence that demonstrates the principle of what I've been calling political atheism in practice. Now, on March 5th, Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson interviewed Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg of Germany on the topic of false flag pandemics. And it was an excellent account of the medical and scientific truths behind the so-called pandemic and so-called vaccines and masks and all the rest of it. But then the conversation drifted over to politics, and sure enough, just as I explained with regard to the protesters in Alberta, the proverbial political train wreck of political fixes from someone who has absolutely no idea of what he's talking about suddenly came forth. And on the return side of our bumper, more evidence of political atheism from a very, very angry Stu Peters. Again, there's a lot to absorb here, but we'll hit on all the essentials when we return. But first, here's Germany's Dr. Wodarg on what he thinks should be done to fix politics and elections.
Is there a political answer to this? Like, do we need politicians to rise up and be voted in? But it just seems like we keep getting the most corrupt people in these very important positions and nothing changes. I know I follow Christine Anderson and some of the great work that she does. I see that she is very vocal about corruption, very vocal about these things that are destroying our nations. But, you know, these are not people that are necessarily in, you know, with real power to make changes.
I think it's very difficult for politicians to do it because we are used to have politicians in a party. And in a democracy, you know, there is the people who should govern. We should have their elect their representatives. But between those people who are in parliament and those people who vote, you always have parties. And the party is the place where the corruption goes in politics. The party is makes it easier for people to buy politicians. So I would like to have some system where we have only direct candidates without parties. And the people gather in a region, whether in a constituency, and they look for the one, they look for the representative whom they really trust. And if he's corrupt, there should be some quorum for about 10% or so, so that they can recall him any time. So this would mean that we don't have elections anymore. The parliament is always changing because the constituency can send someone. And if the someone is corrupt, he can say, no, we don't want you anymore. We may have a new election, find a new candidate. And this, in each constituency, this can happen anytime. So there is no election campaign anymore. The media is not important anymore because the people have direct contact, can have direct contact with the candidate, and the media is somewhere. So this would save a little bit democracy, and this would be a solution I'm striving for. I was member of a party, and when COVID started, I was member of another party, who was a new party, protest party against all this. But I found out immediately those people who are lobbying politicians, they come to each party, which party ever. And all those parties are influenced by money. All those parties are influenced by some economic power. So I'm against parties now. And I think it's possible. We should discuss this very intensively. But it means that the constitution or the laws, the election laws, have to be changed. And I don't know the way now how to manage. But if the people go on the streets, and if the people just don't go to parties anymore, and even there are in Germany, it's possible to have some direct candidates. We could start with them. We could just find some direct candidates who's not member of a party and send them as our representatives to parliament. And I think this idea is very attractive for all those people who are tired with the politics they experienced.
Yes. Well, I do. I kind of agree with you. There's a party that I really like in Canada, the People's Party of Canada. But, you know, independence might be a very good way to go. They just are not running with a party. They're just running. They can make a pamphlet the same as anyone else that says what they stand for. And you can start really electing people to go in, because those would be members that would bring into accountability some of the things that are going on.
You know, we used to have, in the politics, we used to have right and left, you know. And this was the president of the parliament who said those parties who were on the right side of the room, they were the right people. And then on the left side, they were the left people. It didn't say anything about the contents of their politics. It was just they were sitting on the right side, they were sitting on the left side. And because many parties came there and it changed who was sitting on the right and on the left. And now they use the word right for something like fascism. And use the left for something like a new communism. But it's not when you see the new communism, they behave like fascists.
Yes. I remember when that Ms. Cullors of BLM basically said on camera, well, we're Marxists, we're trained Marxists. I remember watching that video and going, it was going viral, you know, and I didn't understand. I'm like, who would admit to that? That's crazy. Marxism, that's a thing that we put down, that is over. It's failed and it's back. And now they're training all the kids in university.
There is a, in Greece, there was a party It was a joint party from socialist and communist people, and they had the president some years ago, and it was called Syriza. And now this party got a new candidate for presidentship. And this, he is a very smart guy, and he looks nice, and he's a gay guy, and he comes just from U.S. He's a Greek guy coming from U.S., and he was working with Goldman Sachs. It's a communist party. The boss is from Goldman Sachs. So, you know, I don't know where is capitalism. You don't know what is communism. They just mix the expressions. Our language is no longer, with any doubt, is no longer able to say something everyone understands.
Good evening and welcome to the Stu Peters Show. Joe Biden's State of the Union was absolutely everything that we all knew that it would be. And if this speech, this illegitimate State of the Union, made just one thing clear, if you noticed just one thing, anything while you watched it, if you even bothered to watch it, we would understand why you wouldn't, it should be this. It should be that the political parties, Republicans and Democrats, do not exist. Conservatives and liberals. They're fake. Our constitutional republic is not real. We don't live in a serious country. Our democracy is fake. It's like Santa Claus or the NFL or a safe and effective vaccine. It's all fake. As the old saying goes, it's a big club. And you ain't in it. And they made that little fact very, very clear to all of us, all night. This is a State of the Union address that came from inside the building that was surrounded by fencing once again. A Capitol building surrounded by a wall to keep Americans out of the People's House. To keep you, the American people, as far away from your so-called elected representatives and so-called president as possible. And don't kid yourselves. Don't be a patriotard. Those Republicans sitting their fat asses in those seats, those feckless cowards that call themselves Republicans, were just as happy as the Democrats to be sitting there behind a wall. To be as far away as they could from their own voters, who they hate, who they find totally repulsive and disgusting, and quite frankly, would like to see dead. The entire night, that entire speech was completely disgusting. It was disgraceful. It made the United States look like a complete joke. Just like all of the other State of the Unions, even when Trump, who's also possibly fake, was in office. So you know what? Screw this. Screw that speech. Screw Joe Biden. Screw the political class that was in Washington, D.C., clapping their hands like trained seals. And screw those fake, cowardly, feckless Republicans who sat there on their fat asses, cross-armed, trying to look mad while they played their part in this show business performance that is the United States government. Does anyone? Do any of you, does even one person out there believe that our State of the Union, the state of our disunion, is actually good? We live under the empire of lies. This entire fake infrastructure that we call a government is built on a foundation of lies. And I'm not just talking about the Biden regime. I'm talking about the entire United States government for generations. The state of America is in big trouble. There's no other way to say this, but we do not have a country anymore. We don't even have a union to assess the state of. Our country, what used to be our country, is nothing more than a corporate crime syndicate. It's an apparatus for the global elite to give themselves legitimacy. These people declared themselves the legitimate government of the United States, and nobody's challenging them. Sure, the American people have a lot to say about it. But how much of a difference is voting really making here? You know the truth. It's not making a damn bit of difference. And it's not going to. Ever. You heard Joe Biden. He told us straight up, there is no political solution. He's preparing to rig the election. And he's facing zero opposition. So the real state of our union is this. Nobody is coming to save us. And we're getting closer and closer to the point where the American people are going to feel compelled to take matters into their own hands. They'll feel that they have no other choice. And who among us, who is anyone, to tell them that they're wrong? So this fake state of the union, this fake and gay government that's running our country into the ground, it must be completely dismantled. Completely obliterated, totally abolished and torn down and destroyed, or we won't have a country for much longer. That is the pathetic state of our once great union.
Basically, Stu Peters just boiled the great issue before us down to the fundamental roots and purpose of politics. Will we settle our disputes with ballots or with bullets? We'll be diving into that question a little later on, but the point to be observed here is that what we've just heard is the testimonies of two very different people who are both victims of what I'm calling political atheism. Now, I certainly empathize with a lot of what each of them had to say, but on their abandoned political elections mantra, I could not disagree more. Each of them is looking at the problem in a backwards way. Cart before horse, punishment before crime, effect before cause. It's interesting to hear Dr. Wodarg argue that political parties should be abolished. At the same time, Stu Peters is arguing that political parties already don't exist. Dr. Wodarg's solution to the perceived political crisis was nothing short of delusional and would lead to infinitely worse government than we have now. Mob rule, which is what he was essentially proposing. And to believe that he has eliminated elections when he's just proposed a system of perpetual elections is beyond my understanding. It's kind of like cognitive dissonance. Listening to his suggestions of how candidates should be elected and how they should campaign was so juvenile and devoid of any electoral experience that it only goes to illustrate where the source of our political dilemma truly is. Wodarg says that the party is the place where corruption occurs in politics. Well, what nonsense. A party is a mere association of individuals. If there is corruption in a party, it is in the party executive and representatives as individuals, not in some nebulous party that exists in name only to identify a private association of people who share either values or share corruption. Again, blaming the object and not the subject. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Political parties don't kill democracy. People kill democracy. Says Dr. Wodarg, we used to have right and left based on the side of the room, not on the content of their politics, and now they use the word right for fascism and left for a new communism, but they behave like fascists. Well, right and left have always been based on the content of their politics, despite which side of the room they may have been sitting in. And that communists should behave like fascists should never be surprising. They're two sides of the same collectivist coin, the same collectivist ideology of the left. This statement is evidence of how many people have been misled by what I've identified as the broken political compass. Like north and south poles of an actual compass, on the political compass, left and right represent polarized opposites. The left represents collectivism and tyranny, the right individualism and freedom. And there is no spectrum. I've devoted many a complete broadcast illustrating this very reality, but our emphasis today is on another reality, the culpability of the voters themselves for the mess that we're in, and that includes those who don't vote as well. When Stu Peters says that there are no political parties anymore, what he's really observing is that all of the very much existing political parties are all on the left. There is no party on the right, and has not been for many decades. It's not that the conservative and liberal are fake, it's that they're both firmly planted on the left, leaving a political vacuum on the right. What's fake is the assumed polarity where there never was one. Our country is a corporate crime syndicate, says Peters. Well, duh. Of course. Otherwise defined as fascist, where the government quote-unquote represents private interests and not the general welfare. Peters says that Biden said straight out there's no political solution and he's going to rig the election. Well, if there were no political solution, then rigging elections wouldn't be necessary, would it? Political solutions and electoral solutions are two different things. All the ad hoc campaign victories I cited on past broadcasts that were conducted by the Freedom Party of Ontario were all political victories. Political victories. And they solved the given problem at the time. And those victories resulted in more tax savings and positive results for Ontarians than any policies enacted by sitting legislatures. But Freedom Party has not yet achieved an electoral victory because most voters don't support freedom. They prefer the illusion of state-funded security. Now, I just about laughed out loud when I heard Laura Lynn Tyler Thompson say to her guest, "Is there a political answer to this? We keep getting the most corrupt people and nothing changes." Well, that very question answers itself. Why do we keep getting the most corrupt people? Because a majority voted for them. Why does nothing change? Because the people who were voted in are the same people who were there before, and they don't want things to change in a direction towards freedom. I mean, how much more obvious is that? And is there a political answer to this? Yes, of course. Elect people who aren't corrupt and whose parties and platforms support freedom and capitalism. Problem solved. So what's the real nature of the democratic dilemma being addressed in this question, given that the obvious answer wasn't even entertained for a moment? I'll tell you what I think it is. No one wants to accept the responsibility for supporting all of the corruption through their otherwise perfectly functioning electoral systems. So instead of blaming themselves, they blame the system. You know, it never fails to amaze me how so many people want to blame the West's various quote-unquote democratic systems, their systems of voting and holding elections, as being the source of the Orwellian dystopia in which we find ourselves. But they're blaming an object instead of the nation's subjects. And the corrupt politicians are the perfect democratic representatives of their corrupt voters. So how can you say the system is broken? If you're asking your politicians to steal from your neighbor to give you a social benefit, how can such a thing possibly be done without being corrupt? Sure, there's a lot of cheating and election fraud, but not enough to affect the greater majority of voters. Voters who always vote against something and never for, you know, those type. Unless, of course, it's for the lesser of a given number of evils, which is still evil, regardless of its measured quantity. And that's just another way of saying that you're voting against something. Whenever honest and uncorrupt politicians attempt to run, they're always rejected by voters for stupid reasons like, oh, you'll never get elected. Well, another self-fulfilling prophecy uttered out of the mouths of the voters. The average voter is not necessarily a creature of politics, but a creature of an electoral voting system. The electoral system is mere mechanism based on counting votes and numbers. It's about winners and losers. But politics, more broadly speaking, is about ideas, philosophies, and ideologies. And on this count, I can only repeat, it ain't so much what people don't know that gets them into trouble, it's what they do know that just ain't so. For example, most voters believe that fascism is an ideology of the right, but the reality is that freedom and capitalism are represented by the right, and I've gone into a series of all these mythologies about left and right. But a political party, let's make this clear, is a private association, and as such, it is a creature of our fundamental right to freedom of association. The purpose of a political party, obviously, is to elect candidates, but the political goal and direction of the party is determined by the party's founders and executive. people who join parties in order to attempt to change the nature of the pre-existing party are undermining the entire political process and the purpose of the party that was being set up by other people in the first place. And only an unprincipled, undisciplined party is capable of being changed in this way. Parties should ideally be formed around fundamental principles, but alas, they are usually formed around not-so-fundamental interests. So when a candidate chooses to run under a party banner, he or she is obligated to promote that party's message, whatever it might be. You don't join a party that you disagree with. What kind of nonsense is that? Now, freedom's general problem as a political objective is that it only serves the general welfare. All other political manifestations serve some specific interest of some specific constituents. That's why the phrase in the public interest is so dangerous to any democracy. And is there a political answer for this? Yes, but there's no electoral answer for this in the short term. You know, political action for freedom always boils down to a full-time mission of eternal vigilance because the war is never won. It's not like an election. That eternal vigilance is best expressed in an organized way through a political party. Electoral politics, on the other hand, is about battles and not the war. Now, I understand that a group called Fair Vote Canada is now campaigning to have proportional representation adopted as the basis of our voting system here in Canada. What possible political problem are they trying to address with this unprincipled approach? Proportional representation is a meaningless term and is tied to mere numbers and not to ideas, principles, or philosophy. First past the post is the only moral way to win an election, for good or bad. Unless a party or candidate has a clear mandate to follow through on their platform, they cannot govern morally and they cannot lead, as any kind of proportional or opposing ideologies, having to be taken into account, would compromise the elected party's objectives. So you can well imagine the surprise of some of my earlier political opponents and associates when Freedom Party, a supposedly tiny quote-unquote fringe party, participated in a political poll and was one of the few to oppose proportional representation. In fact, proportional voting systems are the very breeding grounds for political party corruption, since all of the so-called proportionality is always based on a political party system. It's the parties that get the proportions. I mean, how can you possibly have any kind of proportionality in a parliament or government where every sitting member of the House is an independent? Then what would proportion mean? Proportional to what? The number of votes received by all of the other candidates fielded in a specific riding? Some ridings have 20 candidates. What are you going to do? Proportionally divide the power among all 20? Nobody's going to be able to govern at all. There is no possibility for leadership or sound moral governance in such a scenario, which is why so many on the left endorse some variant of what they call direct democracy, which is not democratic at all. And in a free democracy, when it comes to voting, it would simply not be possible to vote on any measure that would violate individual rights and individual freedom. That alone would eliminate 90% of existing legislation. Now, before I continue, here's more on Joe Biden's State of the Union address, this time as seen through the eyes of Tucker Carlson on his March 8th report.
Good evening and welcome to the Tucker Carlson Network live. Well, that was quite an experience watching that. You know, you think of Joe Biden as a doddering old man, a guy who can't remember when his son died or when he served as vice president. And of course, that's exactly who he is, and it's on display every day. But Joe Biden is also a cruel and vicious demagogue, a man who has no problem at all denouncing his fellow Americans or putting his political opponents in prison, as he has done. And that was all on display tonight. That was possibly the darkest, most un-American speech ever given by an American president. In fact, it wasn't a speech. It was a rant, entirely lacking in decency or generosity to his fellow Americans. In Joe Biden's very first sentence, he compared Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. He did not describe Trump as the other party's candidate, which he is, a political opponent in a country that's had peaceful elections for 250 years. No. According to Joe Biden, Donald Trump is Adolf Hitler. He is an existential threat to freedom and democracy. If he wins, you will die and so will your country. That was the first sentence. But that was really the last time he mentioned the United States at all, for paragraphs and paragraphs. Biden quickly explained that actually his top priority has nothing to do with America. His top priority is sending billions more to Ukraine. A foreign war in Eastern Europe, a war across the world that has nothing to do with the United States, that the United States is not obligated by any treaty to join. Of course, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. A war that can only hurt this country, and already has hurt it in grave and permanent ways. The invasion of Ukraine is the most important thing to Joe Biden. Not ending the invasion of our own country by drug cartels, which control huge swaths of the southern United States at this point. Not our degrading economy you experience every day. Not our collapsing schools, schools where kids can't read at all. Not the 100,000 fentanyl deaths every year. Not the declining life expectancy that is obvious if you look around. Collapsing public health. An epidemic of suicide and murder, things that hurt Americans, ghost armies of drug addicts living on the streets, right outside the chamber where the speech was given tonight. None of that matters. Biden's top priority is aid for Ukraine. It was deranged. You watch as you thought, this is insane. Does anyone in the room think it's insane? They must. Here's how the Republican Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson of Louisiana, newly elected, the man who leads Republicans, in fact, the top elected Republican in the United States of America. Here's how he responded as Joe Biden told the country that the invasion of Ukraine is his top priority. Watch this.
Overseas, Putin of Russia is on the march, invading Ukraine and sowing chaos throughout Europe and beyond. If anybody in this room thinks Putin will stop at Ukraine, I assure you he will not. Ukraine can stop Putin. Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that needs to defend itself. My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down.
This is crazy talk. There's no explanation of what the goal is here. There's lie after lie. Ukraine can stop Russia. No, it can't. This has gone on for over 2 years. NATO is stronger than ever. No, it's not. NATO is on its way to collapse, as is the economy of Western Europe. For not one sentence did Joe Biden explain what the goal of this exercise is, when we'll know we've won, and what the future should look like. Again, it was crazy talk. And yet, Mike Johnson, the Republican Speaker of the House, nodded gravely. Oh, of course, he is completely on board with Joe Biden on this Biden's signature issue. And that's not a guess. As of this afternoon, Mike Johnson is secretly supporting Biden's agenda, sending another $60 billion to the oligarchs in Ukraine. Johnson plans to let Democrats onto the floor of the House to vote for this. This is a stealthy procedural move designed to shield him and other Republicans from criticism. Oh, the Democrats did it. But that's exactly what it is. He's the Speaker of the House. He could stop it, but he won't, because he's on board. So why is he on board? Is Mike Johnson representing his own voters as he backs Joe Biden's signature agenda item, a war against Russia? No, he's not. Republican voters in Louisiana are not for this. Republican voters nationally are not for this. They hate this. It has nothing to do with them. And it's insulting. As their country is invaded, we send billions to prevent the invasion of another country that we have nothing to do with? But the Uniparty demands this, so Mike Johnson is doing it. And so at some point you ask, well, why are they demanding this, actually? Why is war with Russia the most important thing? If you look at the numbers or a map, it wouldn't be obvious that Russia would be America's main enemy. There are other candidates. Could it be because Russia is the largest white Christian country in the world? Maybe. Could it be because they're getting rich from war? Well, that's certainly true. And there may be other reasons as well. We could guess. But we don't need to. because we know that it's happening, and we know that war against Russia is not the only war we're going to be engaged in, and not the only one that Biden announced tonight. Biden also told the country that we're going to have boots on the ground in Gaza. Really? Or admitted it, in fact. American forces have actually been there for months. Did you know that? Did anyone ask you? Has anyone explained to you, no matter where your sympathies lie, what the point of this is? When we'll know we've won? What's the objective here? American lives will be at risk. But of course, no one's told you. And of course, you already know the point. The point is to suck the United States into another foreign war that can't possibly help the United States, a war that can only hurt us and already is hurting us. And we're doing this not because it helps us, but because foreign interests are demanding that we do it. America is being used, as we so often have been. And the result of all of this is that the world is now closer to nuclear war at this moment than at any time in history, closer than it was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have no idea where this is going. You never do once people start to die, once wars begin. No PowerPoint can tell you, no speech to a joint session can tell you where this is going. It's dynamic. It's completely unpredictable. And that's why wise people pause before accelerating. But there are no wise people in charge in either party, on either side. Do you think Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has any clue what will happen in a war with Russia? Of course not. You can't say where this is going. This is so reckless that it qualifies as suicidal. And maybe they are, but the rest of us aren't. But the most interesting fact of the speech was the emphasis. There was not a meaningful word for the entire duration about the things that actually matter to people who live here, like crime or inflation or fentanyl or the foreign army now occupying our country. Joe Biden doesn't care. There was no upside for you in any of the things that he said.
I want to protect fundamental rights. Pass the Equality Act. And my message to transgender Americans, I have your back.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Trans children, I have your back. That's not creepy. But that's what he's offering. Abortion, war, castration of children. Not better roads and schools, cheaper electricity and food. No, abortion and war. Who wants all that? I mean, some tiny percentage of CNN contributors think those are the most important things. But most people would rather have cheaper electricity, cheaper food, better roads. And so what this means is that underneath all of the talk is a dire political reality. Joe Biden can't win. In a fair election, Joe Biden will lose in November. He cannot win. That's the thing that nobody in any media wants to say out loud. In a fair election, Joe Biden cannot win. So they're saying the opposite. Here, for example, is the pregame analysis over at MSNBC, which we watched while waiting for Biden to dodder up to the stage, waiting for the amphetamines to take effect. And keep in mind, as you watch this analysis, these are supposedly the smart kids. These are the smart kids, the ones with complicated glasses. These are the ones the White House looks to for guidance. And here's their analysis of Joe Biden's skills. Watch this.
This seems like a weirdly, like, a counterintuitive hot take, even though it's the most obvious thing you could say, which is that Joe Biden is good at politics.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Like, Joe Biden is good at politics. He's very good at politics. Like, the man really does know what he's doing, and you really see it in those sort of situations.
Joe Biden is just really good at politics. It's the one thing he's really good at. Really? If Joe Biden is so good at politics, why is he losing to Donald Trump, who the rest of us were assured was a retarded racist, who no normal person would vote for? But now Joe Biden is getting stomped by Donald Trump, but he's also at the same time good at politics? Right.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And I think there's a bit of an irony in Tucker Carlson's judging Biden's political effectiveness on the grounds of his electoral ineffectiveness. Recall the distinction I made earlier in the show between the political, which is about ideas and ideology, and the electoral, which is about a numbers game and counting votes. Personally, I think that a guy who manages to lie and cheat his way into the White House, despite the electoral reality, is damn good at politics. Our very zeitgeist of the day has been determined by the Democrats and their left-wing ideology. Electoral politics and voting be damned. When Tucker Carlson suggested that this was, quote, possibly the darkest and most un-American speech ever given by an American president, end quote, I would have to disagree. Biden's State of the Union address was a friendly romp in the park compared to the speech he gave in Philadelphia on September 1st in 2022. When the New York Times published the verbatim transcript of his September 1st speech in Philadelphia, it was described as a speech about the ongoing threats to democracy in the United States. And that threat, of course, was Donald Trump. Quote, Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic, proclaimed Biden. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies. You saw law enforcement brutally attacked on January 6th. We can't allow violence to be normalized in this country. We are all called by duty and conscience to confront extremists who put their own pursuit of power above all else, end quote. Well, that, of course, was pure projection. Projection is a form of psychological or tactical self-defense, primarily used by those who are guilty of whatever accusations are being projected. Worse, Biden's terrorist rhetoric created expectations of a false flag event, and it was that that rightly caused the greatest concern at the time. But when it came to quote-unquote democracy itself, Biden's message was all but lost in the controversy generated by his fascist demeanor, visually asserted in imagery as undemocratic as one could possibly imagine. Now, in my own reading and analysis of Biden's speech at the time, I counted no fewer than 32 references to protecting democracy and zero references to protecting freedom. And given that Biden regarded Trump and the MAGA Republicans as extremists threatening the very foundations of America's republic, and given our theme of political atheism, coming up next is an interesting comment made by Donald Trump back in 1980 as it resurfaced this week on Sky News Australia on March 7th, and which addressed the very phenomenon of why good people and competent people, those mostly on the right, are the majority of what I've labeled political atheists.
For some people, the ultimate goal in life has been becoming the President of the United States. Would you like to be the President of the United States?
I really don't believe I would, Ron, but I would like to see somebody as the President who could do the job, and there are very capable people in this country.
Most people who are capable are not running for office. Most men are frightened of politics today.
It is a shame, isn't it?
Yes.
It is a shame. The most capable people are not necessarily running for political office, and that is a very sad commentary on the country. They had major corporations and they had this and that, but they are not running for political office.
Why wouldn't someone like yourself run for political office? You have all the money that you possibly need. You've accomplished a great deal, even though you are only 34. I know there's a lot of things that you possibly can do in the years ahead. Why wouldn't you dedicate yourself to public service?
Because I think it's a very mean life. I would love, and I would dedicate my life to this country, but I see it as being a mean life, and I also see it that somebody with strong views and somebody with the kind of views that are maybe a little bit unpopular, which may be right, but may be unpopular, wouldn't necessarily have a chance of getting elected against somebody with no great brain but a big smile. And that's a sad commentary for the political process.
In the Durham by-election yesterday, CPC candidate Jamil Giovanni won on the landslide in Durham, and that was Aaron O'Toole's riding. So People's Party got 4.4% there. So this was a by-election in Canada. Interesting to see what's happening. A rhinoceros party got 0.2%. United Party of Canada got 0.7%. Yeah, Grant Abraham's party, centrist 1.0%. The Green Party Interestingly, 2.2% less now than People's Party. Yet, you know, I have to say what is interesting, when we were looking for results of this last night, my husband and I noted that they were only mentioning the top, you know, three. And then sometimes, oh, I think they even did mention the Green Party, but they wouldn't mention the People's Party. You know what? When mainstream media is trying to block out a party who actually is doing better than the Green Party, I think it's good news, actually, for the People's Party. It means you're doing something right.
Well, Canadian democracy has certainly deteriorated to the point of irrelevancy when the Fourth Estate won't even mention Canada's only federal party on the right, the PPC. But not only has the political polarity of democracy been abandoned in Canada, so has basic civility between the competing political factions been abandoned. In Robert Vaughan's discussion with Chess Crosby, who was our guest on February 21st, regarding Canada's National Citizens Inquiry, here is an unaired portion of their conversation addressing that very lack of civility.
You and I grow up in Newfoundland. We're almost the same age. I went out to a Joey Smallwood rally once as a young man.
It would have been a worthwhile experience, and I'm sure you remember it.
I do, yes. It was at Mary Queen of Peace Parish Hall there. The thing is that at the time, in the 60s, 70s, 80s even, you look to your politicians as men of respect, men of style and grace, of honor and integrity, who just simply disagree on particulars regarding political philosophy or how to get things done for the betterment of society. So you can look at the leader of one party and the leader of another party, look at them debate, and understand at the end of the day when they shake their hands, you know, maybe the better man win, that it was a sport between men of integrity. Today, I don't see that at all. I see nothing but hatred and vitriol and men of no class, rarely, people who do stand out as people with class. President Putin stands out as a man of class, if you ask me, compared to Vladimir Zelensky. But I digress. What is your impression over the years? Because you were the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party of Newfoundland, leader of the official opposition at one point in time. So you must know of what I speak.
Sure. And my father was a politician from the late 60s through the 70s to 1993. He was a cabinet minister under Mr. Mulroney. So, for example, there was a famous incident in which Dad said something about Sheila Copps, which caused a great kerfuffle.
I know it.
Anyway, that was theatrical. Back in those days, you could have a great kerfuffle, but everyone knew it was for the purposes of theater. It was for political purposes, but it was theatrical. It wasn't a blood sport.
Yes.
And so when Sheila Copps published her autobiography or published a book, she asked Dad to write the foreword, which he did. So, I mean, that to my mind just symbolizes the way relationships were in those days. Politics was hard fought and fought to win, but it wasn't fought to destroy the enemy utterly. Today, that seems to be the way it is, and it's fought with a lot of bitterness and enmity. I just came back from Ottawa, where I testified on Monday before the Natural Resources Committee of Parliament, and you could see that at work in the committee hearings. The genteelness and camaraderie that you might otherwise expect is utterly missing, and it's become a kind of street brawl. People in organizations and in society generally take their cues from the leadership. And if you look at the way Mr. Trudeau, the Prime Minister currently, has conducted himself in the last number of years, throughout the COVID crisis, certainly, and in the last election, he's attempted to divide people. And,
absolutely.
And during the last election, with his vaccine mandate, which he brought out during the election and which helped to lead to headlines in the Toronto Star like this, that's an expression of Trudeau and his approach to dividing the population of Canada. People take their cues from the top. They're not getting good leadership about values from the Prime Minister.
Now, of course, the fact that we were already dealing with a uniparty at the time of John Crosby's tenure in government, having himself been both a member of the Liberal and Conservative parties during his own career, was not really an issue with voters. But at least no one felt threatened back then for simply expressing one's political viewpoint. That is no longer the case today. The reason we're in the big mess we're in today is not because our political structures and institutions per se have failed to do what they were designed to do, but precisely because they succeeded in implementing what the left polarity chose to implement: tyranny. They won the elections. For freedom, the failure was solely the fault of those on the right, those who would have been able to do something but stayed out of the political arena because all they were concerned about was winning an election, just like Trump back in 1980. Now today, Trump has demonstrated that he can win elections, but now the challenge has become greater than that: winning our freedom back. Which is precisely why those on the left are so obsessed with democracy and not with freedom. They want more voting to go on because that's the route to tyranny. Referring back to Biden's speech in Philadelphia, the word freedom appeared only in a single sentence in that entire speech, and there it was repeated twice. Quote, "I will not stand by and watch the most fundamental freedom in this country, the freedom to vote and have your vote counted, be taken from you and the American people," end quote. In other words, he wasn't talking about freedom, but democracy. But here's the point. Voting is not a freedom. It is a specific privilege, a specific right established by citizenship and a whole host of criteria ranging from age to jurisdiction, property ownership, taxation status, and a whole host of other possibilities. Landed immigrants and other visitors to the United States are also not entitled to this most fundamental freedom in this country, but they can still enjoy individual freedom. If anything, voting needs to be limited severely to matters pertaining only to votable issues and never to the fundamental rights to life, liberty, and property. Many people live their entire lives without ever having voted once. Others voted during their entire lives and never voted for a winner, even once. Fundamental freedoms are not among things that should ever be voted about, yet that is all we ever vote about, which is why society is crumbling. Democracy has become the act of robbing Peter to pay Paul. And having said all this, even Biden's implied definition of democracy as a majority rule voting machine is completely false. Democracy is not about majority rule, it's about majority government, under which no one has the power to rule anyone else. And the word majority, in the context of that concept, referred not to numbers, but to maturity, a government comprised of those who have reached the age of majority and are therefore able to consent within an environment of freedom. But that's a history lesson for another day. Tucker Carlson warned that the world is closer to nuclear war than at any other time in history, that things are completely unpredictable, and that there are no wise people in either party. Well, of course, both parties are on the left. But just a few weeks before Biden's Philadelphia speech back on July 21st, 22, we covered New York City's official alert to the possibility of a nuclear explosion there. People laughed at the city's public service announcement, believing that the advice given in it was too ridiculous to be taken seriously. But as fate would have it, I had already been well appraised of the realities of a nuclear explosion and knew that the advice given in that PSA was indeed quite accurate and correct. So my immediate reaction was to take it very seriously. And here we are on the precipice of self-destruction, and people are under some delusion that broadening the voting base is some kind of solution to the crisis of lost freedoms. The battle for freedom is a multi-generational campaign of eternal vigilance. This necessitates the forming of associations that outlive the lives of its members and supporters, and that means political parties dedicated to freedom. It also means having more and more media platforms out there that tell the truth about both democracy and freedom, just as we will continue to do when you join us again next week as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white, under the bedclothes. Everything will be all right.
Good evening. Good evening. If I were smart, I'd go home now.